If Tesla had deployed hyper-personalization, they would have known that I was going to lose my mind going to pick up a car that I had ordered 60 days before, that you get this little bing, your car is ready. Bing, check in at this.
You're tuning in to the InsureBreak podcast. It's the podcast about the latest and greatest trends in insurance. I'm your host, Ash, and I invite you to join us as we interview experts and executives in insurance covering innovative practices, technology advancements, and insight into the future of insurance. This podcast is sponsored by Zelros. Zelros is an AI software solution for insurance to hyper-personalize the customer buying experience with insurance recommendations across all channels, boosting client acquisitions, cross-sell, and upsell. In this episode, we sit down with Lisa Wardlaw. You're in for a special episode today because not only is Lisa a seasoned insurance executive, but she shares personal stories of how hyper-personalization made a difference in her buying experiences. She shares how AI tools could power insurance businesses and the future of insurance as it relates to both technology and the importance of diversity of people in a company. We are joined today by Lisa Wardlaw, former Chief Digital Strategy at Munich Re, former Chief Strategy Finance Officer at Farmers Insurance. She recently joined InsurTech Israel to lead expansion throughout North America, a venture capital and private equity firm focused on helping InsurTech startups at scale. We are going to talk about insurance personalization, AI, ChatGPT, and so much more. Lisa, we are so excited to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so excited to be here. And I'm glad you didn't say former ChatGPT. No, I'm joking. I need to remove some of those formers from my title and just say she used to be a really, really, really boring corporate person. No, I'm joking.
can you give us a little bit of background into your, maybe how you got into insurance and then what you do now?
Ironically, none of us necessarily choose this industry. We say that the industry chooses us. And on one hand, you could say that that's, you know, like a warm and fuzzy thing to say. But on the other hand, I think it's real, right? Like my kids are like, oh my gosh, like my mom does insurance. Like this. But like how I got into it. So I was liberal arts educated. I was the first one in my direct family to get a college degree. And I studied economics, but my father really wanted me to do something that was like, he just didn't believe. My dad's an engineer, runs an avionics shop, runs his own business. And I think it's because I was the oldest and his first born that, you know, graduated from college. He was like, you need a career. And so I was like, okay, I'll go do this thing called public accounting. But I really, really, really loved what I deemed the more esoteric parts of finance and business. So financial modeling, economics, like, I would have gone on to get my PhD in macroeconomics, honestly. So I end up going into this thing called public accounting to kind of make my dad proud. And I literally didn't know. I became a CFO later in life, but at that moment in time, I'm like, what's auditing? I barely knew accounting. And so they were like, you know, thank goodness Coopers and Lyman back in the day, they just really wanted people who like learned fast and worked hard. And they were like, what are we going to do with this person that doesn't understand like manufacturing or auditing? Or, you know, I did have enough accounting credits to sit for the CPA exam. So fast forward to, because I had an economics background and just this love for financial modeling, it was so natural for me to do insurance. Right. Like it, because insurance at the end of the day, and we're going to talk about the tangible part, which is customer experience, but insurance at the end of the day is basically fulfilling and taking something that's intangible and making it tangible. And so I fell in love with it, first of all, because like I had to, because I didn't know what else I was going to do to pay the bills. My husband was in law school and it's like, you know, like, what are you going to do? But no, I fell in love with the bigger vision and the bigger purpose. And I'll go one step further, which I think ties into probably what we'll talk about. You know, we always talk about insurance and serving a purpose to its policyholders and society and people, which is totally true. What I think a lot of people forget, and you know, you can kind of see this with some of the SVB declines and like all the things that we're going through right now, there is not a high performing nation that does not have financial services backing it. The world needs financial services more than just, you know, consumers need to buy this. But because what do we do with the collection of these things called premiums? We buy most of the world's treasury bills, bonds. You, we're conservative investors, so we end up backing the pillars of gross domestic product and economic value. So Ash, long answer to your question, but it drew me in because of the macroeconomic purpose of it, which happened to tie into my background. And then, yeah, I've just gotten to spend a lot of years learning and playing different roles at different organizations, kind of seeing the entire value stream.
So Lisa, tell us about what you're doing now in terms of, you know, InsurTech Israel.
I spent so much of my early years. I'm just like in the prime, right? So most people, when they have their midlife crisis, they decide to, I don't know, go buy a fancy car or go take some amazing trip or I don't know, like do some, like go parachuting or like, you know, like what do I do? I'm like, oh, I'm going to quit my corporate career. Literally, like I remember this distinctly. It was like Memorial Day weekend, right? 2 years ago. I'm like, I'm quitting my corporate career as a CFO. And one of my friends was like, yeah, everyone else is like, what? And I definitely think people were like, are you sure you don't need mental help right now? I'm like, nope, I'm waking up on Tuesday. And I resigned with no plan, Ash, at all. And I'm like, I'm going to go into InsurTech. So, I mean, why not? What better cure for a midlife crisis than to go from 25 years in corporate insurance and PwC, like, you know, the Ivy Leagues of Ivy Leagues, and say, oh, I'm going to go like kick it over in the InsurTech world. So I did that for 18 months. And intentionally, I didn't pick InsurTechs that I had any corporate depth or experience in. So I picked at the time like geospatial because I'm like, I want to go do something totally different than what I've done before. And that then led me to talk about recognizing patterns. So I'm going to get to InsurTech Israel. I started noticing these patterns. And so whether I was in the company or whether or not I was trying to partner, because, you know, we have to partner a lot in the InsurTech world and space, I started seeing these patterns with, you know, how, like, first of all, revenue and ARR and plateaus and carrier meetings and proof of concept, like the treadmill of proof of concepts, and how do you get off that treadmill? And so I started talking to a lot of founders. It was just very natural for me. I was like, oh, well, like, do you see this pattern? And what you see is like the same thing I see. I just saw this 20 times over. And then I would say, but you know, like the carriers are kind of thinking about it like this. And so I just naturally and very organically, I guess I started like inserting myself into these conversations. And I'm a natural problem solver. I should have admitted that. I like to solve problems. And so I ended up, as the story goes, and I don't know if Kobe will remember this, so we can tag Kobe Benelak and see if he remembers that. But he and I, oddly enough, Lynn, we met at an InsurTech Insights panel. We were on a panel together and we were competing about the trends. And the joke is I beat him. He's like, I didn't even know I was playing. You know, he's very Israeli and competitive like that. So we've known each other for a while. And then we're at this InsurTech Connect event at a dinner, at an MGV dinner in Vegas. And Sabine van der Leeden, who's one of my closest friends in InsurTech, she and I are there. And then Kobe comes up to us and Kobe's like, hey, you know, like you're in the US and I've got this InsurTech delegation coming to the US. You think you'd want to come? And I don't know. I'm just like, sure, I'll come. Why not? Like, and so what that turned into is me helping come, and I did the InsurTech USA roadshow. They usually come once a year. And I met the team. They did a 5-day roadshow. It's incredibly intense. They went to Des Moines, then New York, then Hartford, then Stanford, or I think it was Stanford, then Hartford, then Boston. And I missed the Des Moines and Boston because I had to fly to Berlin, but ended up hanging out with them. And again, I like started answering questions and just started asking, like, how do you do this? That then turned into Kobe and I identifying a need, which is there's a lot. So first of all, I like to say that innovation birthplace is predominantly in Israel or somehow adjacent to Israel. There's so much tech and the incubation there is just amazing. But I like to say that in the US, we know how to commercialize it. So it was very natural for Kobe and I to see a need. And he's an astute business person, as am I. So we saw a need and we're like, hey, we can create an extension of what they're already doing in Israel, which is really incubation, acceleration, investment, and strategy. And they do delegations, of course. We can then extend that to say, if you want to grow, scale, launch, expand, or even if you've plateaued and you want to go to that next level, we can help you with that. And so that's what I'm doing now at InsurTech Israel.
Okay. So I guess maybe a little bit more broadly, you know, what does personalization mean to you? And then maybe if you can give us an example of that, that would be great.
So this is one of my hot buttons, which is why I love talking to you all about this, because you know.
We know all your hot buttons.
I mean, one of my many hot buttons. This is definitely up really high. I think that most people entered personalization in this non-personalized way. So what it was is, and so sorry, Ash, data science used to have a dotted line to me in one of my former roles. And so I would always ask the data science team, is anybody doing something that's not a regression analysis, like meaning reverting to the mean? And they would all look at me and I'm like, $100 Starbucks card right now, if you can give me anything you're working on that's not reversion to the mean. And they would just all stare at me. Needless to say, I didn't have to make any of my promises for the $100 very often. So what I mean by that is we've entered a world where we have so much data and so much data capabilities. And we've applied that data to basically like an 80-20 rule. So if we revert to the mean, how do we then put people into these journeys? Which is why like even things like user journeys and customer experience things, I'm like, oh, I start to like have a little bit of a panic attack because Lynn knows this. By the way, like, I mean, I have so much fun with all my friends that do this stuff for a living. And I'm not the one that does this. I just get to, you know, challenge it. Personalization to me, Ash, to answer your specific question, means I am not part of any reversion to the mean. I, as Lisa, do not fit, like, you can't bucket me as saying, like, you know, post-midlife crisis, female, blah, 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 and put me on a user journey that, you know, like everyone else, my age, blah, 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 location, geography, whatever would fall into. Because personalization to me means you literally know so much about me that you, A, know things that I don't even know about myself per se that are like more buried in my sub-behavioral context. And then you're teasing that out to support me, right? Because I may live in the same area as some of my friends or like whatever, but I have very different personalization things. So the best experience that I can probably give, if I really had to think about like two experiences that just like really rate really, really, really high. The first one was when I bought a really, really expensive German car brand. And I went in and you know, the guy's talking to me on the phone and I'm like, dude, seriously, I don't do demos. I don't do any InsurTech demos. I don't demo tech. I look under the hood. I'm an architecture person. I'm like, you want me to buy it? No demo. And so here I am. And I'll just say, like, I worked for a German company. So we were supposed to have a German car. And so I went to buy my first Mercedes, which was truly like out of my, like, I'm a Honda Accord girl. So like, you know, I go into this world. I'm like, what? Like, I've only had a Honda like my whole life, right? So I go to Mercedes and they want me to like test drive it. And, you know, they're going to bring me like whatever the best coffee and all the stuff. I'm like, I don't do this. So I laughed and I called the guy and I'm like, there's a couple things you need to know about me. I don't test drive. I'm not going to fall in love with it until I see like the way I buy. My dad raised me buying cars too. Maybe I should admit that. Very engineering, like, right? Like, I want to know how it all works. I want to know the price point. I want to know this. I want to know that. I want to know that you can get the color and the da-da-da. Like, he had to special order the leather, all the things. And then when it shows up on the lot, I'll go sit in it. And if I don't like it, you put it back on the lot. And if I like it, I'll drive away with it. And you have to be able to do all that under 5 minutes. Like, no more than 5 minutes, because I'm also impatient. And he's like, okay, game on. And I'm like, cool, I like you already. So needless to say, I bought my car from him. But the experience in the store was amazing, right? Because there's all these people doing all the things I told them I wouldn't do. Like, right? And I like, kind of like the VIP line. He just takes me back there. I sit at this desk and he's like, you need to sign the contract. And I'm expecting like paper, right? He's like, no, it's like in the, it was like embedded in the desk. It was like a screen in the desk, and he signs it and then he flips it over and then I sign it. And I'm like, what is this world? Now you have to remember, this was like 2016-ish. And so then of course, like it was like, I said timer on my phone. Less than 5 minutes, I had possession of my car. So then the funny story is I go get my car and, you know, I hadn't done anything. I hadn't seen it. I hadn't driven it. I mean, I just picked it all out. Then the woman, the customer success woman, she's like, so do you want to know how to drive it? And I'm like, wait, you mean I now don't know how to drive this? She's like, well, you know, it's got, you got to remember this is 2016. It's got the self parking thing and it's got all these things. And I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm willing to push that button. And she's like, well, you probably need to learn how. So the joke is, like, my husband's like, if she doesn't come out in 5 minutes, that means that, like, we got to go pick mom up because, like, you know, she's not gonna buy the car. So I ended up in there 35 minutes because I spent 30 minutes learning how to drive the car for a lot. And I should mention that I clearly got rid of that car. But I'm a Tesla person now. We can talk about all that later. But my experience with buying the Tesla was horrible, like so horrible. I'm like, I'm going to tweet Elon Musk now. This place is horrible. You can put rockets on the moon, but I can't get my car. Like, what? But driving a Tesla is seriously phenomenal. But yeah, I had to sit in my car and watch YouTube in the Tesla to figure out how to drive it off the lot. So I'll give you a comparison of that. That's not really what you asked me, Ash, but hyper-personalization means, had Tesla deployed hyper-personalization? So we'll take it out of insurance for just a minute. We can kick it back to insurance later. If Tesla had deployed hyper-personalization, they would have known that I was going to lose my mind going to pick up a car that I had ordered 60 days before, that you get this little bing, your car is ready. Bing, check in at this little time. Bing, show up. And they would have known that I had probably previously been a Mercedes, like whatever, customer. And then I go there and they're like, who are you? What car are you picking up? Are you sure you got a text to come in today? Then they give me the car and it's not even my car. And I'm like, no hyper personalization, which was almost more insulting to me because by now, like, I bought that car a year ago and I'm not here to criticize cars. Like, we could talk about insurance. My expectations have totally transformed by now, right? Because now it's 2022. Everything's digital. You know, we just come out of COVID where everything was like, you know, to your trunk, to your door, no touch, in, out, thank you. You know, now we've entered a world where you don't even expect to talk to a person. And then I just really thought, because the car drives like a rocket, I really thought it would be so much better. So I'll leave you with that. That's a difference between almost over-engineered technology that's still not delivering a curated customer hyper-personalized experience, because it seems like it would, but it fails, versus, oddly enough, the Mercedes experience was a person saying, oh, if I'm going to get this customer, I got to find a way to make all this work. And so I think that that's an interesting lesson to keep in mind. Hyper-personalization means that above all else, you know the customer. They know Ash, they know Lisa.
Yeah, yeah. Now, can we talk a little bit about tech? So, like, you know, generative AI and ChatGPT, how is that, like, the technical, how is that the technology impacting the personalization experience?
Like, before we even go into generative AI with ChatGPT, which, of course, we'll get to in a minute. But the first thing is, if the AI is not hyper-personalized, which I will, like, $100 Starbucks card, if you can show me AI that is actually not reverting to a mean. So one of the problems, the foundational problem that we have with the tech to begin with, is that we've applied it to more an industrial common denominator parameter as opposed to hyper-personalized. So the first thing that we have to do in the tech, Ash, is there's a lot of techniques coming out with personalized federated learning, leaving the data where it is, doing behavioral and federated learning models, like without lifting and ETLing all the data. So that's like one huge tech aspect, which is how do we get more precise federated learning models without the cost and the compute of co-locating the data? This is why we've been generically, it's not like we've been cheating the system. But again, remember, AI came into being when we were just going to the cloud and we're dealing with all these cloud computes. Like it's a teeter-totter. We're always balancing the business cost and load against what we're trying to achieve. So regression to the mean was an outcome, right? I've got a lot of people that run quant computing that are my friends too. Okay, so now if we move over to generative AI, which you can almost see the same pattern emerging. So I just say, be careful the patterns that we put ourselves on. We've got generative AI coming out and we've got a combination of, you know, we need to deploy it. We're afraid to deploy it. But we need to get out there. And I call it like the first mover conundrum that insurers are not really good at. And I'd love to hear your and Lynn's thought on that too. But at the same time, we need to really think through how we're going to deploy it in a way. And my favorite word, Ash, is to avoid being insultingly intelligent. Meaning, as a consumer, you know, I can play with ChatGPT on my phone. Like my 13-year-old asked it to write a paper in the car yesterday. And I'm like, what did you just do? So we are not stupid as consumers. And we, tech has been so democratized that we have access to it. Meaning, ergo, we can understand the experiences we should be receiving from the products and services we buy. So we have to be careful that when we apply it, it's not insultingly intelligent. Meaning we're throwing a nice little buzz at the front of the process, but we haven't really thought through, like, we should be doing better than I can do in my car on an open source app, right? Now, I'll balance that by saying, please, insurance industry, be first movers. Let's be first movers. Like, yes, we need to be within regulation and we need to be bridled and we need to do all the things, but we don't need to be talking about how we implemented ChatGPT like 5 or 10 years from now. I think what I'm hearing people talk about is they're going to start using it in self-service. So I've been doing cognitive AI for a while, Ash. Like I started looking at cognitive AI, I guess back in like 2015, 2016, which for insurance would have been cutting edge. I understand that it's been under development for like 20 years, but deploying it, like applying it in operations, that would have been pretty cutting edge. But when we start to look at these things, we always just stop at the user experience at the front end. The point, let me say it differently, the point of sale. What I would say we need to be like intentional about is if we have that experience at the point of sale, how do we extend that experience throughout the entire behavioral chain? So think of something like servicing your policy. Like I need to change my address. I'll give you a great example. I just converted, I'll use a non-insurance example. I just converted to Google Fiber. And I can't deactivate my my Wi-Fi because there's like literally not a button that says deactivate my Wi-Fi. And I'm like talking to the chat. Where's the ChatGPT there, right? So what I'm saying is when we do servicing, and I think intentionally sometimes we hide deactivations from people. I won't go there. But we need to also be putting ChatGPT in servicing, in claims handling, in things that enable me to be more productive and efficient using my services that I'm purchasing. And I think that a lot of times we get like almost maybe peer pressured into like, well, we got to use it in the front end. And then it's like, we go to like a different level. Like we went from a rocket ship to like a horse and carriage by the time we got back to like filing a claim. I'll give you another great example. I won't name names. But not only did my car get ramrodded, my insurance company did a horrible job of having a claim setup process. I picked like the preferred shop. No ChatGPT involved, Ash. There should be ChatGPT involved because here's why. I have a Suburban. It's pretty big. And I picked a body shop that came up as an applicable body shop, right? I waited 6 weeks for an appointment to take it into the body shop because of all the supply chain things. So it's been sitting in my garage damaged for 6 weeks, unable, you know, I can't use it. Finally, this week, yesterday, get my appointment. I'm going to go get, you know, I'm going to get my Uber and get my ride home from dropping it off at the body shop. I'm so excited. I'm like, finally. So I call them randomly just to make sure. I'm like, I want to make sure I can drop this off. And they're like, yeah, no, you can't bring your car here. I'm like, what? Why can't I bring my car there? I will not. By the way, you all would understand that I'm not with like any like non-big name insurance company, right? Like I only have like air quote the best. I'm like, why can't I bring my car here? Well, because we don't work on cars that big. Then why was it ever recommended to me as a body shop? Why did you accept my car? Oh my gosh, why did you book an appointment and make me wait 8 weeks to bring it here? And of course, the poor person on the phone is like, I don't know. That's a really great thing where I could see generative AI coming in and compounding all those scenarios and really helping with not only what's out there generically, but then connecting to routing and handling and doing a much more, I'll call it elevated and elegant experience, Ash.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm hearing is, you know, it seems like, okay, regression to the mean is not personalized enough, right? So it needs to be more hyper-personalized. But then also, if you get too hyper-personalized, maybe it's creepy and now it's regulatory issues. And it seems like it's hard to find kind of like a sweet spot. If there's a way for you to kind of explain like a good spot where it's like, there is personalization, but it's not to the point where it's creepy. I think the other day I was like, talking to somebody about going to Vegas or something. And then like an Instagram ad popped up, like things to do in Vegas. I was like, whoa, that's kind of creepy. So, I mean, I guess, yeah, in terms of like, you know, like how do you, or, and then if it's not regression to the mean, what methods are there like quantitatively?
I would advocate that most of us, if it's bettering ourselves and our lives and it's making something efficient and curated, to quote Marie Kondo, if it's sparking joy, I don't think I'm ever going to think it's creepy, ever. Like, I don't know. But if I'm running late and all of a sudden I have to jump over and pick up my kids and DoorDash knows I usually order tacos at 7 p.m. on Tuesday night, because Taco Tuesday, and it is like, hey, you haven't done this yet. You want me to go ahead and place that order? I'm going to be like, that's really cool. That just made my life more convenient. Now, we could maybe say that I don't want it to know that, and you could select privacy options out of that. But as someone trying to balance 5,000 things, I'm going to probably lean into that. As long as it's bettering myself, as long as it's offering an experience of sparking joy, I'm not going to think it's creepy. When I think it's creepy is when it's what I call dumb, insultingly intelligent, upsell, cross-sell. So in your case, it's creepy. You were talking about Vegas. It did nothing for you other than like, hey, here's a Vegas ad. It did solve a problem for you. It listened in on you and then gave you an ad. That's what I call old school. That is not hyper-personalized. Absolutely not. Hyper-personalization would be understanding how you like to travel, when you like to travel, and then offering you solutions that are making your life more efficient. And I'll say to you, I like things that make my life more efficient. You may be somebody that likes to do research. So hyper-personalization delineates between our behavioral tendencies as well as the fact pattern. So that's one really big delineation between like regression analysis and quantitative analysis. That's why I hang out with a lot of people that do quantum. Because what you get, because actually they're kind of cool to hang out with. You wouldn't think that, but they're really cool to hang out with. Like one of my friends is a VC guy and he's running this quantum company in Poland now. He's just so cool. And the thing that he and I often talk about is scenarios. And the problem with achieving hyper-personalization is that the scenario-based compute power would be quite large, right? Because if you think about it, if you don't regress to a mean, there's not like infinite, but there's like lots of scenarios. And there's so many logistically involved. If this, and it gets well beyond a decision tree, I guess is what I'm trying to say, like inarticulately. And when you get well beyond that, it's like you have to apply a way to learn from that. So you're now combining behavioral, contextual, logistics, scenarios. That to me is solvable, by the way. But we haven't been thinking of the patterns and the problems because we've just been, which is the point about generative AI. Something new comes out and we do it. And we try to get what's new out implemented, but we haven't really thought through how does this connect to all the other things that I have going on, which, by the way, have matured a lot. So if you think of the first laughable example, like getting to the cloud, you know, it was like, take everything to the cloud, take it now, take it yesterday, get to the cloud. And then we're like, oh my gosh, that's expensive. Yeah. And the CIOs are over there going, told ya, on-prem had a value, you know? No, it's not like, it was never an either or. It was that we weren't bifurcating the problem along the way. And so I see a lot of the same, Ash, with the tech. And the thing about the tech is it grows and develops and morphs. Like even this personalized federated learning, the accuracy of that has just been developed by, I happen to know the co-founders that developed this technology. That's just in the last, you know, I'll call it like 6 to 12 months, because personalized federated learning 3 years ago was just not very accurate. So I think part of the problem here is we have iterations that are going on. And as enterprises, as good as we think we are about being dynamic and iterative and agile and Scrum and all the things, we pretty much are still on this pre-digital tech wavelength of every 3 to 5 years, we do something big. And so as we're doing these things, we're not expecting to come back and revisit them as iteratively as they need to be revisited. So maybe that's the bigger point here, is when you're doing anything, generative AI, the tech, et cetera, you need to build it in an elastic way that's never once and done. Because there's always going to be layers of this that compound and enable you to do it slightly better, slightly more efficacy, apply more efficacy to it than even 6 months ago. And I just don't think our technology programs and consumer customer release schedules, yeah, they weren't really designed that way, even though we kind of have adopted this agile strategy.
We always ask each speaker about diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. What are your thoughts on DEIB in the insurance space? And do you have a personal story to share?
So, I mean, of course, being a woman in insurance, and I might add not being an actuary, right? Like, so there's different levels of inclusion and belonging. And so first of all, making sure people feel that they belong, even if they don't come from an insurance background, is super important to me. And that can be race, religion, gender, upbringing, nationality, all the things. So that is very important. I think in addition to that, even before we get into the specificities of being a female in this industry, I've spent my life as being the only non-actuary senior executive in the boardroom. So add to that the fact that I was a woman. The only other women were usually the head of HR, or you had to be an actuary. And so I was definitely I could count them on my hand, one of the only women who were like one level, like there's board of management, one level down, and what they call the next level down. So a direct report to someone who reported to board of management. And to have that role as a female and a non-actuary, I took on two levels. First of all, clearly I was very proud. Secondly, I was like dismayed, like where are all the other people like me? And I didn't mean like me, like look like me. I mean like me, like where's the diversity here? And then the third thing is I took it as a personal mission. Like I have to make sure people understand that they can get here too, right? Like one of my colleagues used to run this company in Canada called Move the Dial. Her name is Jody Kovach. Her brother actually is the CEO of Wealthsimple in Toronto. Michael Katchen, and Jody ran an amazing organization. And they had a saying that has always stuck with me. You cannot be what you cannot see. And so I think it's important for people to see the diversity, the belonging, the different backgrounds, the different perspectives, because clearly we're not going to solve all the things we spent this podcast talking about if we don't bring in different perspectives. And for me, the biggest risk our industry faces, I mean, okay, getting people to want to come to it to begin with, you know, it's not the sexiest industry, but as we all talked about, it draws you in. And I think the biggest risk, I'll say outsiders feel, so you can be an outsider for many different reasons, is that you feel like you don't belong. You feel like it's a world in which you're not welcome, a world in which you may not be appreciated. And that can be for so many different reasons. And why stay in an industry where you don't feel welcome or a sense of belonging? Nobody wants to do that, right? Like we all want to feel that we belong. And not only that we belong, that we have the ability to carve our initials on that bedrock that we're trying to, you know, jackhammer through. So I think that that's super, super, super important. I also think that, you know, as an industry, we have very, very, very historically been, you know, not only are we a stodgy industry, but we have the type of, you know, numbers of male dominated, you know, white male dominated, you know, suits and ties. And yeah, I'll just kind of, I'll extend all the stereotypes, right? Like all the board, you know, and no disrespect to my Lloyd's colleagues, but the Lloyd's of London, you know, sitting at, I mean, even that entire process just offends me when I go to Lloyd's. It's like, it literally offends me. Like the women's restrooms are only on certain levels because, you know, women weren't allowed at Lloyd's. I'm like, I can't believe I'm in here. And there's not women's restrooms on every floor. The Lloyd's lab, the Lloyd's lab doesn't have a female restroom on that floor. And I'm like, what is this? So I know Lynn's going, wow. Right? Like I was so like, Lynn, that's you can crazy. Imagine my face when I had to walk to another floor. Like I almost had to get a hall pass to go to the bathroom. And I'm like, is it really 2023? No. So like we have a long way to go in our industry, but I say that, and then I step back and I say, but I can count 40 women and 40 people from different, you know, socioeconomic, ethnicity, backgrounds, different, you know, like all the things. And there's not people that I just don't get so much energy and love that are just leading this industry forward. So I do think that we do a great job there. And I guess maybe the last thing I'd like to say about that, because, you know, it's Women's Month and lots of people talk about, you know, how we can amplify. You all did an article that I was like very graciously honored to be part of. I think a lot of times we focus on, you know, we look like this and we need to look like that. What I focus on is every single one of us needs to come as our authentic selves. And that will, not only will we look different outwardly, our gender, our skin tone, our hair, you know, we will look different in our energy levels and the way we communicate. And we will also look different in the way that things are important to us, the way that we represent things that are important to us. And I think if we can usher that in, we will then truly have a diverse workforce. So those are the things that I think we need to focus on. And I guess I bundle all that into enabling people to be their authentic selves. So that, I guess, Ash, would be my like way I wrap all that together.
I like that. Okay, well, the final question is, if you could go back 20 years in time and give yourself one sentence of advice, what would you tell your younger self? And by the way, you can't say that you don't buy a Tesla or something. We already heard that story.
I wouldn't say that. I like my Tesla. I would probably tell myself to not be so conditioned to connecting my identity to a job or a title to make, oddly enough, my family proud, being the first person to graduate. I would probably tell myself to lean into those subtle white patterns that I felt and I didn't lean into, because I was like just trying to like make sure that I like not climbed the ladder, but make sure that I did my family proud. And there were a lot of times in my life where if I would have listened to it 20 years ago, I probably would have evolved into who I am. Oddly enough, you're always who you are, but who I am now, a long time ago. So I would have avoided that midlife crisis, Ash.
You would have avoided going and spending money on a Tesla.
Nah!
This podcast is sponsored by Zelros. Zelros is an AI software solution for insurance to hyper-personalize the customer buying experience, with insurance recommendations across all channels, boosting client acquisitions, cross-sell, and upsell. Thank you for tuning in to the InsureBreak podcast. Join us next month as we interview another insurance executive to gain insight on innovative practices, technology advancements, and what the future of the industry looks like. See you next month.